This UCSD-TV program is presented by University of California Television. Like what you learn? Visit our website or follow us on Facebook and Twitter to keep up with the latest programs.
And thank you for coming to the Charlie Fest, and this is a session on biology and conservation. So I'm Victor Avakier, and I'm a professor emeritus of marine biology, and I've had a long association with Scripps. So I've been associated with Scripps because my father was a professor here beginning in 1957, and then I worked here, I had my first position here in 1960 as a summer student, and I worked for the kelp ecology program from 1961 to 1965, and then I went away and established myself after a few postdoctorals at UC Davis. And that's when I started my own laboratory. And my laboratory was focused on the process of fertilization. And in those days, nobody knew anything about it. They knew that spermatozoa and eggs got together, and you could see that with a microscope. But no molecules had ever been isolated that had anything to do with sperm-egg interaction in any system. And the only experimental system that was amenable was the sea urchin. So those in the world, there were about 100 people who worked on sea urchin fertilization, had a very nice system. And we thought that it would be a conservative process because when you looked at it with a microscope, it all looked the same, whether it be a mammal or a sea urchin or a fish. But in fact, it turned out to be quite different when we started looking at the molecules. Now, President Nixon gave me an unexpected gift. Probably the first time, and without knowing it, he did this. But I applied for my first grant in 1973, and I asked for 2 years from the NIH. And he had withheld the NIH budget for several months, and it created an enormous backlog of cash. So instead of giving me 2 years, they gave me 3 years and 20% more money than I asked for. And that would never happen today in today's NIH, I guarantee you. Okay, so I started working on the molecules, trying to isolate the proteins that were involved in animal fertilization using the sea urchin as a model. And we were quite successful at that, and that's what caused me to get a position at Scripps in 1978. Because they were very interested in cell physiology at the time here, in animal physiology, and there was little thought of conservation at the time. So conservation biology hadn't really become a catchword yet. Okay, so things were very good here, and what no one's mentioned is actually one of the reasons that Scripps scientists are successful in what they do is because they have really good graduate students working in their labs. And no one's really mentioned that before, but in fact, our graduate students are quite superb. And you can tell this by looking at their careers 5 or 10 years past their PhD, what they are doing. And by and large, they do an excellent job. Okay, so I had an excellent career here, retiring in 2008, and I'm still involved with the institution in many ways. And the institution is a big part of my life, and so is UCSD. So the big picture in marine biology today is conservation biology and the development of avenues of research and public policy that are relevant to good stewardship of the world's ocean and its resources. And they're threatened today by overexploitation. And of course, the human population increase with 7.2 billion people on the planet now create an enormous hit on ocean resources. And the idea of ocean mining now is coming up. And of course, a lot of that's going to involve the continental shelf. Okay, so I'm the moderator. I'm not going to say anything more or show any slides. And the first speaker we're going to have is Lisa Levin from Scripps. So Lisa, please tell us something about yourself and your research.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy birthday, Charlie. Okay, so many of you don't know about Charlie's early life as a construction worker. There he is. okay, so we are asked to tell tell the audience who we are. I'm a professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. I work on seafloor communities ranging from shallow water intertidal salt marshes to the deepest parts of the deep ocean and everything in between, more or less. I've never worked directly with Charlie, but we did intersect in Venice Lagoon, and we were exploring the Mohs Gates. I don't know if you remember that picture. Yeah, so that's where that's sustainability, Charlie, up there. Okay. So in trying to think about, I'm the director of the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. I'm also the section head for the biologists here at Scripps. But I thought I'd try to give you a feeling for the field I'm going to talk about. And when I came to Scripps in 1976 as a beginning graduate student, I wanted to be a marine ecologist. After 6 years here, I left with my degree in biological oceanography. I became an oceanographer. I'm very proud of that fact. Over the next decades, I actually really feel like what I practiced was ecological oceanography of some sort, a blend of ecology and oceanography. Some will argue they're the same thing. But in recent years, I would say the last 5 to 10 years, I feel like I've become a conservation oceanographer. And you don't hear that term very much, but I think it's a very important expression of the changes that have happened here at Scripps and around the world. So we were asked to talk about two major events, breakthroughs, discoveries in our lifetime. My scientific lifetime is almost, but not quite, 40 years. And the first of these, I believe, is a discovery that changed deep sea science forever, and that is the discovery of life and ecosystems thriving without sunlight at the depths of the ocean. So the discovery of hydrothermal vents in 1975 revealed communities reliant on chemical energy rather than sunlight. These animals live off of chemical energy. Sulfide and methane oxidation are involved in the fixation of carbon, and these fuel amazing animal communities full of tube worms, clams, mussels, crabs, and much more, all with microbes, of course, at the base of this. Now, the first vents were discovered in 1975. We now know of over 600 hydrothermal vents on mid-ocean ridges and back arc basins. About a decade later, just under a decade later, we discovered the first methane seeps. These are places on continental margins where a methane is emitted from the seafloor. It's converted through anaerobic methane oxidation and a syntrophic combination of archaea and bacteria to create huge amounts of sulfide, which fuel communities that are very, very similar to hydrothermal vent communities. And we now believe that there may be as many as tens of thousands of methane seeps along our continental margins. And then sometime, and the first of these was discovered on the Florida escarpment in the 1980s. And then shortly after, we came to the realization that large organic falls reaching the seafloor and decaying, things like dead whales, decaying wood and logs, also yield sulfide, high concentrations of hydrogen sulfide that fuel very similar communities to hydrothermal vents and seeps. And this discovery, I believe, has really truly changed the field of deep sea science in many, many ways. One is that it introduced the deep ocean to the public. How many of you have seen those National Geographic specials from 30 years ago with giant tube worms and hydrothermal vents? A lot of the audience. I think this inspired a generation to be interested in the deep sea. These discoveries have revealed a huge wealth of new biodiversity, new families, genera, species, and a lot of evolutionary novelty, especially in the realm of symbiosis, but also new eyes, new metabolic pathways, and we're still discovering this novelty. This discovery led us to rethink almost all the deep sea paradigms that had reigned from the first 100 years of deep sea exploration. We used to think the deep sea was a homogeneous, stable desert, basically, with very little food. We now know that Animals don't simply rely on phytoplankton falling down from the surface, but there are sources of chemical energy and carbon fixation happening at the seafloor. We know that animals aren't all small because they're hungry, but that some animals, when they have a lot of food, they can get big. We now know that all the rates in the deep sea aren't very slow and all the animals aren't long-lived. When there's a lot of food, as we find at these reducing ecosystems, they can grow and reproduce very, very quickly. There have been many different kinds of industrial applications. It's probably worth pointing out that the whole PCR revolution is based on thermal microbes. They were discovered at hot springs at Yellowstone initially, but they also have been harvested now from hot springs in the deep sea. And of course, it's changed funding and how we fund science. And the Ridge program at NSF is one example of a focus program that looked at reducing ecosystems across disciplines, not just biology, but geology, physics, and so on. Now, in terms of evolutionary novelty, this is one of my favorites. These are the dancing yeti crabs from methane seeps off Costa Rica. These crabs are waving their claws, which are full of sulfide oxidizing bacteria. They're basically bathing the claws in sulfide and removing waste. And as you can see from this, they then consume these. So in this case, we have bacteria governing the behavior of deep sea animals. And you know, this brings to mind an article I read very recently about the human microbiome governing our cravings for chocolate and other things. I don't know if some of you saw that. But, you know, bacteria probably rule everybody in many ways, and it's especially true at the deep sea floor. Now, my own work has been involved in many different aspects of the deep sea, and I just mentioned here we've discovered what I believe is the world's first archivore, a worm. This Dorvalea polychaete right here with an isotope signature. For those of you who know stable isotopes would recognize that that's very unusual. This worm is getting its carbon from methane oxidizing archaea that have fixed that carbon and then worked with sulfate reducing bacteria, and the worm is eating the consortium. So this is lighter than methane, but the worm is getting its carbon from methane. Archaea produce lipids that have extraordinarily light delta C13s of minus 100 or lighter. We've worked a lot on niche partitioning. The ecosystems I study, the methane seeps off California and Oregon, host large numbers of worms that look very, very similar and are very closely related, and yet they all live together in the same rocks, in the same sediments. What we've discovered using stable isotopes is they exhibit trophic partitioning. They each have a different isotope signature. They're each eating and assimilating different microbes from that environment. So the microbes in these ecosystems are like the plants on land and in shallow water. They are the food source, and the animals can coexist by partitioning that resource. We've also discovered that hydrothermal vents and methane seeps aren't necessarily separate entities. Off the coast of Costa Rica, we have a subducting seamount that basically is plumbed down to the mantle, and warm waters are being brought up through methane-rich continental margins, and so we have elements of methane seeps and hydrothermal vents living together. And I call this a hydrothermal seep. And it really just reflects the fact that there's so much we don't know about the deep sea. I often open my talk saying we've seen less than 5% of the seafloor, much less of the water column. And I think there are organisms and assemblages and ecosystems and many, many processes still out there to discover. Okay, so that's my first breakthrough. And the second breakthrough that I think is really important is not so much a single discovery, but a recognition. And Vic alluded to that already, and that is that humans are now key species in marine ecosystems. We turn out to be key players and influence many, many processes. And you're going to hear about these from the other speakers, and you've already heard about some of this. You know, we have a huge influence in climate change. We are affecting fish populations and fisheries through fishing and bycatch. We are going ever, ever deeper with energy extraction, and we're poised for deep sea mineral extraction. But we're not only taking things out of the ocean, we're putting things in addition to putting in CO2, we put in tremendous amounts of contaminants and waste in the form of plastics and chemicals and pharmaceuticals, and also a lot of unintentional waste that happens when there's a tsunami or an earthquake. So humans have a huge influence, and so over the last 25 to 40 years, we have all of this influence has generated a set of problems in the ocean that require social as well as natural sciences to solve. And this is where enter Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. I'd like to tell you about this center. It was founded in 2001 by Nancy Knowlton, really with tremendous vision, but also with tremendous support from the director at the time, who was Charlie Kennell. And I have to say, the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation would not exist without the spiritual and moral and financial support of Charlie Kennell in the early 2000s. And that support has continued to this very day. So thank you, Charlie. And I think the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation ushered in a new type of science for Scripps, and that is conservation science. You see, Vic started basically giving my talk at one point there. Those of you who were at Scripps back in the 70s when I was a graduate student know that we were not taught to think about conservation. We were taught to do basic science and go on in academia. Well, I would say with CNBC, and we have a new way of training students through our MAS program and our interdisciplinary PhD programs. We have now begun to train students not only in natural sciences at Scripps, but to become conversant in economics, in policy and law, in communications, and a host of other interdisciplinary areas. We also have established really important partnerships with other departments at UCSD, economics, RADI, IRPS, and many other social sciences departments. We work very closely with NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, with the Environmental Law Institute, and many other partners. And so I feel like this is heralded really over the last 10 to 13 years, and maybe I have to say, acknowledge Russ Chapman, raise your hands. He was the executive director of Scripps back there in the early years, and he also deserves a lot of credit for all of these changes, along with Nancy and Charlie, and the second director, Jeremy. Okay, so what's changed? We do conservation science, and I think we now see a very different type of student. For example, we find Scripps students at the climate negotiations. Here are three of them with Christina Figueres, who's the executive secretary for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. They were in Warsaw giving talks, giving some of the only talks on the ocean, manning an ocean booth, and being very active in climate policy. This is something quite new for Scripps. These CNBC students really deserve a lot of credit for this. We see Scripps hiring conservation biologists. You're going to hear from Stuart Sandin, so I didn't put him up here. He's one. Recently, we've hired Octavio Aberto, and so we find Scripps doing the kind of science that underlie ecosystem valuation or the interactions with fisheries and fishermen and artisanal fishers. Everything from social issues to testing different kinds of gear to conserve the fish and to conserve the endangered mammals in the Gulf of California, for example. These are just a few examples. Of course, those of you who know me know you have to hear about the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative. CNBC is now bringing stakeholders together to help guide environmental management in the deep sea. This is a deep ocean industrialization is something that is happening. People don't realize most of it's going on. Extensive leasing for minerals mining, lots of oil and gas drilling, lots of deep water fishing, and basically much of it's happening without any holistic strategic planning of how to manage the deep ocean. And so we're trying to bring together regulators, industry, natural scientists, social scientists, policy, law, economics to have this conversation and provide guidance to those regulatory bodies that are in charge. Okay, so I'm trying to stick to my time. I want to thank Charlie and Ellen. See, Ellen had a construction worker phase too. And thank you all for listening. Happy birthday, Charlie.
We thought we'd have all four presentations and then have an extensive question and answer session. So Doug Bartlett.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name, as Vic mentioned, is Doug Bartlett. I'm an environmental microbiologist and a bacterial geneticist. And I won't tell you very much about what I do in my lab. I thought I would give a more general overview of some of the seismic events over the last few decades in environmental microbiology. Over my career, though, at Scripps, which has spanned 25 years, we've been doing work on how microbes form biofilms, the presence of pathogenic microbes in the ocean, and especially, and this goes back to interactions with other faculty here years ago, looking at microbes in deep ocean environments. Okay, well, I'm an environmental microbiologist, and I'm also the son of a microbiologist. My dad was a pharmaceutical microbiologist, and as a graduate student, my dad was involved in one of the golden eras of microbiology, which had to do with the discovery and the exploitation of antibiotics. And here's a picture of Dad. There is a graduate student with all kinds of fancy gizmos there going through a fermentation to make some antibiotic. And so that was certainly a very exciting time. 30 years later, there was the start of another golden era in microbiology. And so that's what I want to say a few words about. It has to do with sequencing. It has to do with genomics. And I'll start this conversation, and I think later today, Larry Smarr will take it to a whole nother level. So stay tuned. But in the early 80s, when we were just starting to clone genes, it was a very personal, laboratory-specific affair. You had to know a certain amount of protein biochemistry because you had to purify the enzymes that you were going to use to cut and stitch together DNA. And so you had to do some purification. You didn't go through outside vendors to get these reagents. You made them yourself. When it came to sequencing, again, it was right there at your bench where you worked, where you did the electrophoresis, and where you looked at the autoradiograms and counted each base pair manually. And so that was how we did the work then. And while sequencing wasn't what we all did, as PhD students, it might be the cap to a really great thesis. And so at that time, in the early 1980s, maybe one gene would get you a PhD. You'd have to do some more work to get that one gene, but maybe one gene. Okay, so let's go to the present now, 30-some years later, sequencing now. We get our samples from all over. The diversity is tremendous. We may filter that material or not. We may use the whole material en masse, or we may use very sophisticated methods to tease out every single microbe that is in that population. And using techniques that are much more sensitive than the polymerase chain reaction from femtogram amounts of DNA will amplify the genome of individual microbial cells and characterize them. Or we'll collect all of those microbes, we'll extract all of that DNA, we'll take that DNA, we'll prepare libraries, we'll use next-generation sequencing technologies such as that of Illumina Corporation here in San Diego to sequence in massive parallel ways. We'll get large amounts of DNA sequence, and with the appropriate sorts of algorithms, we'll stitch together that DNA and we'll characterize it. So the amount of sequencing is enormous. And we've gone from, in my world, kilobase pairs to gigabase pairs. Again, in other cases, it goes grander than that. But it's at least on a million-fold increase in the amount of sequence that we get. And now it's trivial to sequence a microbial genome overnight, or many microbial genomes overnight in individual labs here on campus. So what a sea change that has meant for how we look at life. And I don't think any of us appreciated what it would mean to the kind of work we did, from the individual lab operations to the large-scale operations that we see today. And one of the things that's happened is that biology faculty today are more and more like those in physical oceanography and in geophysical sciences and in other fields. And by that, I mean there are some people like Lynn Talley who go out and get their hands dirty, and there are some people who are really skilled at the computational methods needed to make sense out of all that sequence information. And so we have this division. We have people who are more computational savvy, more mathematical, more conversant in statistical approaches. Things have become more quantitative, and as Mark was talking about yesterday, we really have gone from analog to digital in this world. So one of the other things that's happened in microbiology today is we've become so much more quantitative. This is a view not through a telescope, but through a microscope of seawater where the particles have been fluorescently stained. And so we're looking at this universe of microbes in a drop of seawater. And we know today that there are more than 10 to the 30th power microbes in the ocean. We know that every second there are 10 to the 23rd power of virus infections going on. We know that since the start of this symposium, 20% of the biomass in the ocean has turned over, and we know that 90% of the biomass in the ocean is microbial. So we've become much more aware of the numbers of microbes and their role, how it influences all the various biogeochemical cycles in the ocean. And as we've married these quantitative skills with genomics and with the appropriate optics, we're able to look at this sea of microbes and say, okay, there are some, we can check those guys off, we know a little something about them, but there's a lot that we don't know. This is microbial dark matter. We know that they're there. We have some addresses for them in terms of evolution, so we can say a little bit about, you know, how they evolved, but we don't know what they do. We don't know basic information, and sometimes this is at the fundamental divisions within the microbial world. So even at the phylum level, there are many new discoveries to be made. So this is the dark matter that microbiologists work with today. So this transformation in genomics of microbes has taken us in many different directions. So in the troposphere, the middle and upper troposphere, now people are looking at the atmosphere as a biosphere for microbes and as a integrator of the physics and chemistry of the atmosphere and looking to see what's there. And so there are microbes associated with the oxidation of dimethyl sulfone and that are using small organic acids apparently in the atmosphere. And those microbes are being characterized thanks to genomics. We know that in the subglacial systems of Antarctica that have been characterized by people like Helen Fricker, a glaciologist here at Scripps, that now microbiologists are looking into those lakes and looking at how ecosystems removed from sunlight like the dark ocean operate and what are the energy sources there and what are the microbes that are in these subglacial systems. And we also know that in physical oceanography, as we look at various fronts that different microbial populations exist, and those are being characterized and correlated with the physics and chemistry of those environments. And even in the deepest minds now, people look at microbe-mineral interactions thanks to these technologies. So where will this all go in the future? Well, maybe the sky isn't the limit, so we'll see. I don't know if we'll be able to apply next-generation sequencing to astrobiology, but certainly some of the approaches that environmental microbiologists used will be applied to places someday, some generation of graduate students in perhaps other ocean environments like those of Enceladus and Europa and other places as well. So we'll have to wait for that. We're certainly going more autonomous. I think that was also a comment that Lynn Talley made the other day, yesterday, and that's true. When it comes to genomics, we are using moorings. We're going towards the use of autonomous underwater vehicles, someday profiling floats. Why not Argo, to obtain samples to get nucleic acids? And so some of this technology is going on today. And then just in ending, of course, we're making use of all this sequence information. There's a lot of integration of that that's going on. And so people are finding ways to genetically modify microbes so that they are used for purposes of interest. So it could be biofuel production, could be making use of the many pathways of dark CO2 fixation to go from electricity to chemicals for industry. And more this has to do with synthetic biology, that is, making the DNA from scratch. And these synthetic biology approaches have been pioneered at the J. Craig Venter Institute, along with a lot of metagenomics. And I think one of Charlie's legacies is helping to promote this relationship between UCSD, the campus as a whole, and the J. Craig Venter Institute that now has this beautiful platinum-rated building just up from our aquarium here. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
So one thing that may have been overlooked is that Charlie is actually responsible for this beautiful auditorium that we're in this entire building with the restaurant on top, because it was his negotiations with the Scripps family and all of the architects and everything who actually put this place together. And it's used by the community as an auditorium. So the next speaker is Stuart Sandin from Marine Biology.
Hi there. It's great to be able to participate in this event. Happy birthday, Charlie. It's terrific to be here. I wouldn't miss it. So my name is Stuart Sandin. I'm a professor of marine ecology here in the Marine Biology group. I've been here on and off for about 10 years. I won't get into the details of all that. Academic positions I've held at the university here because I was an undergraduate, et cetera, that would take up to 10 minutes. But I do want to talk a little bit about the work that I've been doing and the way that I got into these problems. I'm getting to the punchline that will involve the human interaction with the ocean, in particular with fishes, but then I'll touch on microbes. So don't worry, I feel like there's a microbial theme right here, so I want to make sure the people who love microbes are happy. So I was trained actually at Princeton University, and Princeton's not necessarily well known as a marine program. I was a theoretical ecologist, a community ecologist, worried about how species interact with one another, worried about how when you have many species, what happens? How do those species interact, and what do you actually get as an ultimate product? The typical case study people use to study community ecology is trees. Right? Trees don't move. You can count them. Grasses don't move. You can count them. Well, I'd like to argue that fishes are the next step that we should go to. That was my inspiration to get into community ecology and to get into studying fish biology. One of the best quotations about fishes is that fishes are like trees, except they're invisible and they move. So it makes this study really easy. But you could see as a person interested in community ecology and a person interested in the ocean, fishes are a very charismatic group. I got attracted to it because they're beautiful, they're fun, they're really interesting to study. The population dynamics of fishes are something very popularly studied when we try to address questions of fisheries biology. Fishes interact with one another. We can, for the coastal fishes in particular, we can sit and watch them. We can watch two species interact in a competitive way. Predator-prey dynamics. We can even find mutualisms, something that a lot of people hesitate to say, and some, in fact, Russian ecologists in the early phases got in trouble for not saying that was the only thing going on. Weird juxtaposition. We get in trouble for talking about mutualism. They got in trouble for talking about competition. But you see a number of very beautiful interactions. And from the very scientific front of me, I love studying fish. They're beautiful. They're interesting. They can describe basic ecological principles. Well, we can address this as long as we want, and we can spend time diving. We can spend time fishing. We can spend time doing all forms of observation. But at some point, we need to realize that we are now a big player when it comes to fishes. The human dimension is where we need to start focusing some attention. And this is where I want to take us. I've got put a couple too many photos in here, is this part of it. We can study the fishes as they are in nature, but the fishes as they are in nature are not the common way that we see fishes today. Very often today, we see fishes in a setting like this, in a boat, feeding a growing human population. So I'd like to start with just giving a little bit of an overview of where we stand as a planet, as a population, 7 billion and rising, with our relationship with fishes and fisheries, in particular marine fisheries. Okay, if we go back 140 years and we think about 130 years and we think about our perspective of fisheries, it was that it was limitless. Right? Huxley was if you guys know Huxley, he was known as Darwin's bulldog. He was a comparative anatomist, very interested in comparing species and seeing where things, how things were related to one another. Darwin's bulldog, because he recognized that two species could be related. He was one of the first people to point out that dinosaurs, little carnivorous dinosaurs, were likely the progenitors of birds. He also was stood up on stage and had very famous debates saying that humans were related to apes. Well, one of the shortcomings of his understanding of evolution is that he thought about relationships but didn't think about timescales. And in fact, if you go through the history and think about Huxley, he had troubles with the idea of gradualism, this gradual evolutionary change. He had troubles getting around his head around this idea of natural selection, that it's this steady process. So it's not surprising to imagine he would say this about some of the world's major pelagic fisheries, that probably all the great sea fisheries are inexhaustible. Why do I say this? Because it's been a slow process. It's a gradual process to watch the fisheries change. It's something that takes time. Of course, we know it's not true. Of course, we know that the human footprint is palpable, that we're having an impact that is noticeable. The cod fishery here, we just take the east coast of Newfoundland and we look at the cod. I mean, this is a famous case study. If you look at other parts of the cod populations, we see drops. This is probably part and parcel with almost every fisheries trend that you'll see, big to small. Well, let's look at the large pelagic fisheries. This is looking at those three species that he's pointing out, the pilchard, the mackerel, and the herring. And you can see that through time we've had bigger and now declining fish landings. Okay, well, we can discuss the anchoveta. That's an interesting one. We've actually had a bit of good management there. But by and large, what we're seeing is some at least the effects of people. It's not limitless. We can have an impact that's noticeable on these fish populations. This is a graph that outlines the human fisheries take. This is inland, so it's the freshwater and marine. And what we see is that it's rising. It continues to rise. There's certainly been a bit of saturation now, if you will. We've maybe reached a top, a maximum for the wild harvest. But we're an ingenious species. We're adding aquaculture. And I'm not going to get into the details, but the blue revolution of aquaculture is something that is going to keep the planet going. The fisheries are made up of a number of groups of people. Two of the main groups that we think about are, typically when we think about the open ocean fisheries, it's the large-scale fisheries, the commercial fisheries. But we can't forget the small-scale, the artisanal fishers. These are the fisheries that are mainly coastal, made up of people who are fishing largely for a local living, employ a lot of people, have a regional impact, and are landing, the number I want to point you to, about the same amount of fish as commercial fisheries. So whereas most of the statistics that we see that report on commercial fisheries and the big dramatic management or problems, well, there's another large population that's taking 30 million tons per year from the ocean. Something to think about and something that we're starting to address through the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. But the one thing I want to end with in terms of the numbers here is this, the utilization, this lower panel here. Human population, we're getting up into 7 billion, right? And let's look at the per capita food supply on the planet. We're not dropping. We are being ingenious. We're finding ways to solve this problem through aquaculture. But I'd still like to point out that we have this huge chunk of marine fisheries that we need to address, and we need to think about how we're going to feed the planet, right? We need to avoid a collapse. Okay, so you've probably seen a lot of trends that show this decline of fish and fish stocks. How is this happening? How are we continuing to grow or at least saturate without seeing a decline? Well, we're fishing further from home. Map of fishing trends across space. We're fishing deeper through time, right? We used to exploit just the top coastal areas. Now we're going deeper and deeper, like Lisa points out. And we're fishing more species. We're fishing down the food web, if you will, fishing through the food web. Whereas we used to target some of these big, yummy guys up here, we now have active fisheries for some of the smaller guys. I'd argue still yummy, but they're a little less popular. We're shifting the way that we fish. Well, there's some ecological consequences to fishing more broadly across the food web. We're changing the structure of the marine food webs. Now, this is a summary, and one of the things we're tasked with is to say, what are we excited by? I'm excited by thinking about how changing individual populations leads to community-wide shifts, right? And this was a summary done with Jim Estes. We looked at terrestrial ecosystems, we looked at marine ecosystems, and just focusing on the removal of some of those big-bodied consumers, the predators, those fish that we typically like to take in the ocean, or the species we're afraid of on land. And just look at these visually, you see these dramatic shifts of what the ecosystem looks like when predators are present or when they're not. This is exciting, and it's complex, and it's not straightforward for us to address. This is an element where community ecology is really giving us some opportunities to understand the system a bit better. We can link in some of these principles of complex systems, self-organization, et cetera, to start to solve these problems. No longer are we dealing with a single species problem, we're dealing with a community problem. Some work we've done on coral reefs, links, here's the microbes for you people that like microbes. You may have a lot of fish in one setting, you don't have many microbes. Long story short, you fish a lot. This was work that Charlie has seen before. When you have fewer fish, you get more microbes. There's a lot of connections to make that happen, but let's just think about that. Fewer fish, more microbes. No longer are we thinking about fishing as just affecting fish. Fishing is affecting a lot of other species, getting down to the single-celled different domains of life, right? Really cool stuff. So the question I want to pose to you guys before putting closure here is one of the things that Lisa brought up with our Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. How do we address these problems? How do we marry the science of fish, fisheries? Okay, we can maybe link that to community ecology. But there's this in the middle, people. The human dimension is something we can no longer ignore. How do we study these problems in such a way that we can learn about the ecology, not ignore the people, engage the people, learn from the people, and then give that information back? And one of the challenges that I think that we have going forward is including our friends in different places, the human side, in exposing them to the science, sharing the science, and applying it to keep people fed, to keep the fisheries going in the decades to come. Okay, with that, I'm going to leave it. Thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Jim McCarthy from Harvard. Jim?
So, good morning. Thank you, Charlie and Ellen, for inviting me, and happy birthday. This is a terrific idea, bringing people together this way. So, like Lisa, I took our instructions rather literally. Charlie asked to say something about what attracted us to our fields, something about important advances. I found that really difficult because there have been many in my lifetime in this, some of them inspiring, and I'll mention a couple, and some of them frustrating and exasperating. And then a bit about the future and interesting opportunities. So I arrived here as a graduate student in 1966. This man was across the country at that other oceanographic institution. But in my first year, I read a lot of his work, and I became really inspired by this statement of his, that life in the sea cannot be understood without understanding the sea itself. And that truly was the philosophy of the biological oceanography PhD program at Scripps at that time, and still today, I hope. But what Redfield had found as he searched the world around looking at plankton was there was a surprisingly consistent ratio of carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. And he puzzled about that, and it was something that I found interesting, and as I began looking at various laboratories around this institution, I fell in with this man, John Strickland, and was very intrigued with the work he was doing. He had come a few years earlier to found the Food Chain Research Group, and after spending some time in his lab, he agreed to take me on as a graduate student, and the co-chair of my PhD committee was Michael Mullen. Soon, though, we learned that John's health was failing. He remained on my committee, but I actually finished with Dick Epley and Mike Mullen chairing my committee. So the work I got interested in was the nitrogen cycle. And, of course, we knew, and Dick Epley was doing a lot of work on this, that the nitrate ion, the nitrite ion, and seawater were assimilated by phytoplankton as an important source of nitrogen. Today, we refer to that as new production. He was working on the enzymes that are involved in the transport and the reduction of nitrate and nitrite. And I became interested in what was happening down here with the release products of heterotrophs, whether they were microbes or zooplankton or fish or any animal in any heterotroph in the sea, including all the animals we've heard about this morning, both as ammonium and as organic nitrogen, and urea here being the case. This today we refer to as regenerated production. So the degree to which this material moves back to primary producers, you can sustain the system, but of course you can't have a burst of growth unless you bring in new production. Using stable isotopes, heavy nitrogen, we actually quantified these rates and began to make comparisons that allowed us to see the relative importance of these other forms of nitrogen. Now, a lot of work since then has shown us that with clever analytics developed by people like the late John Martin, iron, other trace elements also have a surprisingly consistent ratio. Again, reference to phosphorus here is one for the composition of plankton. And this allows you to make some assertment of a system as to how sufficient the nutrient environment is with respect to these requirements. We now also know that a lot of iron doesn't just come in from the atmosphere, which is the primary source of new iron to the ocean, but a lot of it's also regenerated. And I'll come back to that later. And in the theme of conservation, we'll see that this has an important role. So thinking about major advances, I have to say that this was a time when a lot of us were also getting very excited about what we called biogeochemical cycles. And I was reminded yesterday in John Orcutt's mention of a new journal and watching those first papers roll in that in about the mid-80s, I was the founding author of a journal called Global Biogeochemical Cycles. And although AGU was supportive, we had serious debates among the upper ranks of AGU as to whether that was the right title. And there was a problem with two words I wanted to use. One was global. They said, no, that's too big. You won't get any authors. I said, but that's where we want to go. And the other was cycles. They thought that was too constraining. Well, you be the judge. Of course, there have been many editors since me, but I think it's a pretty successful journal. But about the same time, in the mid-80s, I was asked to chair a committee that was charged to launch something called the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. And I was given a committee of 18 members from 15 nations. I chaired the committee from 1986 to 1993. At the very first meeting, Vladimir Kolyakov took me aside, one of the members, one of the two Soviet members of this committee, and he said, we have to talk about this. And he showed me his hand-drawn graphic of the Vostok ice core showing back 160,000 years carbon dioxide from today's level, time of the last glacial maximum, 18, 20,000 years ago, the previous glacial maximum, a previous warm period, the Eemian previous glacial maximum, and of course temperature. And we know today, of course, the Vostok core gave us four of those cycles. You see, you'll recognize here the hand-drawn graphic is this portion. And as he looked at this and saw how rapidly carbon dioxide came back into the atmosphere. And of course, at that, prior to that, nobody had any idea that you could see a swing in atmospheric CO2 by 80 or 100 ppm over a period of a few thousand years. Remember, you know, at this point, we have ice on land. The ocean is low enough to basically expose all the continental shelves. Much of the northern biosphere has been bulldozed away. And this tells you right away, you don't have to think about it very long, that the ocean's got to be involved in this in a serious way, in this return of CO2 to the atmosphere. So this, I think, had an extraordinary impact in many of us trying to see how biogeochemical cycles and the physical climate system were linked. And this was quite influential in thinking at that time. So Margaret Leinen and Mark Abbott and I and others sort of fell in that era to design one of the first programs to try and look at some of these questions on a larger scale. This was developed by SCORE and the International Geosphere Biosphere Program. And the challenge of this study, the Global Ocean Flux Study, known as JGOFS, was trying to understand how organic carbon formed in the upper ocean with carbon dioxide equilibrating the atmosphere, photosynthesis producing organic carbon being consumed, algae being consumed by zooplankton, some of that material in various ways making its way into the deep sea. What were the processes that regulated these fluxes? The biological pump is a phrase I think I first heard spoken by Roger Revelle. And he was extremely interested in this problem and helped us enormously getting this study off the ground. A companion study developed just shortly after and overlapping in this period of implementation was the Global Ocean Dynamics Program, known as GLOBEC, which took us through many of these same processes to look at fishery yield. And so in advance, a lot of conceptual understanding here, and of course one of them was that the processes that give rise to bursts of production, the new production, are largely driven by nitrate coming into the system, the recycled nitrogen. You think of some organisms like the cyanobacteria and the Prochlorococcus. Abundant world ocean over contribute very little to new production. And it is the new production that largely contributes then to the export production. A major advance that made this possible, of course, Mark talked yesterday about the satellite imagery, the fact that we could see globally these patterns. This is the North Atlantic bloom, averaged over an annual cycle, but you see it's intense. This is an area which was a major focus for JGOFS. Now, on the exacerbating scale, you've already heard what's happened to fisheries, but something else has happened in our coastal regions. And there are now about 150 areas, some of them only evident seasonally, where oxygen is depleted in our coastal waters. These suboxic areas, in some cases, are extreme, like in the case of the Gulf of Mexico, actually referred to as a dead zone. It's not dead. It's just that we have put so much nutrient into these waters that algae, sometimes known as nuisance algae, weed-like species, bloom. The consumers aren't there to eat them. They decompose. Bacteria draw the oxygen down, and then you have no habitat for vertebrates or invertebrates, hence the reference to dead zone. The Gulf of Mexico drains 40% of the U.S., 55% of our farmlands, and the problem is that this is, again, globally a serious problem, and in the worst of these, it's actually growing rapidly in its severity. Nitrogen increase into the Yellow Sea and East China Sea is increasing tenfold over a period of a few decades. Gulf of Mexico, two and a half fold. So the exacerbating part is that we know what's causing this. We know that it's largely waste from sewage systems, but from agricultural lands. And even though we know and understand that problem with regard to the agricultural side of it, there is no appropriate response, as in many cases with fisheries on the political realm. They say, well, the fishermen need their livelihood too. This is the story in New England, of course, so you can't restrict their catch. In this case, the farmers often don't have the information or are not encouraged to use the information to manage their land more wisely. So I'd like to just finish now with a few thoughts about where some of this heads with respect to conservation. This is an issue of Frontiers in Ecology and Environment that comes out this month. And we have a paper in here. There are 10 of us who've been working together over the last few years to look at the role of whales in marine ecosystems. And so this particular paper is titled Whales as Ecosystem Engineers. And some of the people already mentioned here this morning, with respect to whale falls, for example, are co-authors. As I said, there are 10 of us. So with a former student, Joe Roman, who's a senior author in this paper, we've been advancing the idea that whales are really very important in retaining nutrients in the upper ocean. And we've actually called this the whale pump, in which whales consuming prey in the upper ocean return to the surface to digest and also to defecate. Now, this little copepod here, which could be the size of a grain of rice, will make a fecal pellet that sinks at hundreds or thousands meters a day. The fish feces also largely sink, but the whale feces don't. They stay in the upper ocean. So this whale, think a blue whale, 100 tons, you know, if it made a turd, it'd be pretty big. But it doesn't. It doesn't. What it does is it makes this plume of very, very fine particulate material. It's, think, the worst form of diarrhea. This is what this whale does. And these small particles have the gut microbes still associated with them. They remineralize nitrogen at a very high rate. We've determined this experimentally. We've done field measurements, laboratory measurements. We've modeled this. And our argument is that the ecosystems today with whales function in a way that reflects the presence of whales. And in many cases, coastal ecosystems in particular, where whale stocks haven't recovered, are not functioning the way they did with the ancestral stocks. And here is the grim data. The blue whale, and although you see blue whales distributed worldwide, the largest population was in the Antarctic waters, are today at only 1% their pre-harvest levels, even though there's been a moratorium on taking blue whales since the mid-80s. The fin whale, 14%, the humpback, 30%, and about 85% of the missing whale stock in the world today is in these three species. Small species like minke have done very well. So we actually believe that that there is a really important story here. And two of the authors in this paper, Steve Nicole and Victor Smedicek, believe that, back to something that Mark mentioned yesterday about iron, in the Southern Ocean, we believe that the whales are really important cyclers and retainers of iron in the Southern Ocean. And one of the reasons that the whales aren't doing well is the food isn't there because it's iron depleted, and whales are a major source of keeping iron in that system. So I'll end there. Thank you again, Charlie. Happy birthday.
So we'll have questions now, and please use a microphone or shout. Charlie?
I guess I can shout. But your last remarks,
turn around.
Yeah, your last remarks reminded me of a story that might lead to a paleoecology question. And that is that I recall reading about 5 years before Henry Hudson actually went to Hudson Bay. He had an expedition to Svalbard, and he came back to the London docks and reported that the North Bay of Svalbard was loaded with whales. And even then, economic correspondence was very good. And within 5 years, the whale population was wiped out. So that must have then led to some permanent ecological change in the structure. And I'm wondering if that's been documented.
Documented, you mean the harvest or the depletion?
Yeah, what was the impact of wiping out the whale population in 1607 or whatever it was?
Yeah. So you're exactly right. I mean, that was a period when not only whales, but seals taken really intensively from that area at that time. There would be no notion today from any evidence we would have as to how that ecosystem looked before fish and whale. But you don't have to work very, very hard with these numbers to realize that whale populations that magnitude would have certainly had an effect. Of course, they're consuming food, but again, unlike
the consumer that would replace them when they're not there, they are retaining a lot of those nutrients in the system.
Next question. Yes? Connie?
Lisa. Lisa, in your examination of the organisms in the bottom of the sea, is there a difference between the organisms in the mid-ocean ridges and those in the subduction zone?
Yes. So the mid-ocean ridges host the hydrothermal vents, for example. They're spreading centers. There are also a lot of hard substrate that's not hydrothermal. So between those two, you get animals that live on, when I say hard substrate, I'm basically referring to rock, basalt or sulfide, something like that. Subduction zones are places where one plate is subducting under another, often under a continent, and these are very close to the margins and the continents, and they're repositories of organic matter. There's a lot of buildup of organic matter, which is turned into methane by microbes, and so you get a lot of the methane seeps that I was talking about at subduction zones. You also get trenches. You get other kinds of slope ecosystems that aren't hydrothermal vents. So, yes, there are different assemblages in all of these settings.
I'd like to ask Doug a question. Doug, why are so few marine bacteria capable of being grown in the laboratory?
Well, that's really the $10,000 question in environmental microbiology. Why do we only culture 1%?
Thank you. 1% or less. They're incredibly diverse. So if you look at the evolution of life, most of that evolution is microbial, and microbes do a lot of different things. They can fix CO2 in multiple ways. They can be photosynthetic. They can use diverse sources of organics. They can be averse to certain kinds of organics. And if you look at the chemistry of seawater and think about how you could vary that for culturing microbes, you have thousands of different combinations of energy sources and things that microbes breathe. Some microbes want to breathe different minerals instead of air, for example. Some, of course, will be strict anaerobes. Some will want to grow under different temperature and pressure regimes and salinity regimes. So there's just so many possibilities that it's really impossible to come up with all the culture conditions to grow everything. And also, some things don't want to grow to high cell numbers, and that's another serious constraint. So we're getting better. Now with genomics, people are finding that some of the most abundant microbes, when their genomes are interrogated, they're finding out parts of their metabolic pathways that are missing, and supplementing those with the appropriate nutrients leads to cell growth. So one of the most abundant microbes on the planet now can be grown to biomass similar to E. coli because of that.
Yes?
We've been looking at the species of whales. Has anybody been looking at the microbiome of other fish and... Has anybody been looking at the microbiome of the different fish populations? And in particular, I'm interested in antimicrobial resistance. And, you know, we see it certainly in land environments, and I'm curious about aquatic environments because a colleague of mine up the coast here at the Laguna Beach Marine Rehabilitation Center has found quite a bit of antimicrobial resistance in the sea lion pups that are found starving and doing poorly, and they rehabilitate them. Some of the organisms are actually similar to what we see on land. I'm wondering how much of the human fecal runoff or, you know, pharmaceutical runoff is affecting the oceans. Thank you.
So is anyone here from Eric Allen's lab? Because Eric Allen's lab is interested in the microbiome of fish intestines. Well, who would speak on that?
I can take a stab at it. So that in terms of the microbiome of fishes, that this is something that's just, it's sort of beginning. It's a young field. It's one that isn't that well developed. What we do know is that you've got all the raw material for very productive for the development of distinct microbiomes in fishes, and the reason for that is you've got the fast turnover of the microbes and the fast turnover of the fishes, and you've got a lot of different species of fishes that can then come and go in the different environments. We certainly know that the fish assemblages are linked. The fish species that are there is linked to the conditions, and they're affected by the coastal activities. You see diseases emerging and stuff, but you're seeing more putative diseases in fishes, but that seem to be part of the population in near inhabited areas where you see white spots on the fishes or this or that. To me, that's got to argue that there is this feedback with the microbiome that's keeping the fish alive. In terms of the data, that's a big data problem, and I don't. You're right. Eric's group is doing that with a few taxa. It's in its infancy, that field, but it's something I think people are starting to turn their head to.
Yeah. Just briefly, we have a project looking at the microbiome with the whale feces. And if you think about it for a moment, the closest relatives to the whales, mammals did evolve on land, are ungulates, and the actual closest relative is hippopotamus, and they're all herbivorous. And yet these whales are feeding on animals, either small crustacea or small fish. And so there's some very interesting questions, and the anatomy of their gut actually, in many regards, still looks like that of an herbivore, which is very different from that of a carnivore or omnivore. So we think that microbes are extremely important in the breakdown of the primary storage product of energy in these copepods, which is a wax ester, and probably also chitin. And so gaining nutrition from material that is their food now, very different from their ancestors, probably involves very, very different microbes in the gut.
There's a very good example of a human pathogen being transferred to a marine mammal, and that's Toxoplasma gondii, which is a very difficult parasite to get rid of because it's a eukaryote just like we are. So it's very difficult to find antibiotics to combat it. But the idea is that this parasite undergoes its sexual stage in cat intestines, and that's why pregnant women should not ever touch cat feces, like clean out the cat litter box. And the idea is that cat litter has been flushed down toilets, and it's ended up in bays and sewer outfalls, and the sea otters, California sea otters, have picked it up. So there have been California sea otters infected with Toxoplasma.
Yes.
So it's a question for Jim. You talked about the sort of human disruption of the nitrogen cycle on a global scale. If your fellow grad Scripps student Dave Carl was here, he would talk about the phosphorus cycle, particularly in the fact that it doesn't have that sort of huge atmospheric reservoir the way nitrogen does, which really allows us to get a lot. We rely on phosphate rocks. So I'm curious what you're thinking of today of where the future goes for the phosphorus cycle and what the human impacts might be on particularly some of the oligotrophic gyre ecosystems where phosphate's often low.
Yeah, I think the story would still be, even though we've learned a lot about phosphorus nutrition and organic forms of phosphorus, phosphomonoesters in seawater, that nitrogen is more commonly the limiting nutrient, and part of that is because of the more rigid, in the Redfield ratios, the more rigidly constrained carbon to nitrogen ratio relative to carbon to phosphorus. Phosphorus, very little of that is used structurally. It's mostly energetically bound up with adenosine moieties and the like. But in that coastal eutrophication story, of course, phosphorus is also very important because if you're just adding nitrogen, it wouldn't work. And as you know, the application of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers is a huge business today. The nitrogen fertilizer is largely synthesized, but the phosphorus is mined. And about 85% of the world's phosphorus today comes from one country, from Morocco. It's got a couple hundred years of supply at the rate we're using it. And, of course, There are other sources. So they'll be more expensive. Lisa knows deep ocean and the like. But I think that's, you know, in these coastal waters is clearly a serious problem. Phosphorus also recycles more readily than nitrogen.
Yeah, sure. I'll just say a couple words. You know, the search for new sources of phosphorus for agriculture has led us into deep water. And so we're now, there are lease claims to mine phosphates from depths of about 200 or 300 meters off Namibia, off New Zealand, off Mexico, and probably soon other places. And these all conflict. These are all upwelling areas with very productive fisheries, so the mining operations are all going to conflict with other human activities like fishing, which are often very important for the economies of those countries. So, you know, there is now a push by some people to look at new ways of recycling phosphorus on land and reusing human waste and other sources of phosphorus before we go into the deep sea.
I would just like to add to that that I just read in Science last week that roughly 2% of all of the fossil fuels burned in the world have to do with extraction of nitrogen as N2 into ammonia, NH3, for fertilizer. So it takes a real hit on just making fertilizer. Yes.
It's been said that In the upper ocean, if you, this is a question for Doug Bartlett, that if in the upper ocean, if you go in a straight line, you'll only cross on average about 4 water molecules before you hit a microbe. So if so, that means that the microbial population is affecting the physical structure of the upper ocean waters. And I wonder if there's a dialogue going on between physicists and biologists about what that might mean in terms of both the physical environment for the microbe, which isn't bathed in virgin water but has another microbe next door, and the physics of water itself, seawater, which is different if it's got microbes in than if it hasn't.
That's a really interesting question. Microbes influencing the physical state of water. So certainly there are biophysicists who look at how microbes move in water. I don't know of any studies looking at how microbes influence the physical state of water. Microbes influence the physical state of their environment in many ways. They can precipitate various kinds of minerals, for example. But actually influencing the state of water, that's a fascinating idea. Water-microbe interactions are extremely important in terms of looking at life at depth. Osmotic pressure adaptation is tightly linked to hydrostatic pressure adaptation. So water macromolecule interactions influence the ability for life to exist throughout the world oceans. But you bring up a different point, which is a fascinating one, and I don't have an answer.
Charlie?
I have a related question, very naive. If you were to take a census of the microbial population in the upper ocean, what fraction would live in the guts of large organisms?
That also hasn't been well studied, because in looking at microbial numbers in the ocean, it's one thing to collect seawater and filter it and count microbes. It's another thing to collect individual animals from the copepods to the whales and look at the microbes associated with them. But when one looks at the content of microbes in animal guts, mm-hmm. including ours, those numbers are very high. Yeah. And I think that a large fraction of that microbial population, especially the fast-growing members, are likely to be associated with animals.
And there would be different kinds of chemical factories inside the guts, because they would live in a more controlled and homeostatic environment. And so you'd end up with a different kind of chemistry depending on the proportion of large species in the upper ocean, which is yet another issue about the large animals.
Yes. Yeah. So it does seem that there are some microbes in the upper waters of the ocean that get by. They're in very high numbers overall, but they don't grow quickly. They have streamlined genomes. They just do a few things, and they do those things well, but slowly. And then there are other organisms that are able to grow very quickly when they find themselves in an organic-rich environment, like an animal intestinal tract. And they have genes for breaking down lots of different kinds of nutrients and a very different kind of hardwiring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Charlie, a factoid that's maybe related, and we've been looking at the distribution of microbes, this with Forest River down at San Diego State, distribution of microbes in a coral reef environment. If you think about the water column microbes and the microbes associated with the benthos, living on the corals, on the algae and all that, same order of magnitude, number of microbes on 1 square meter of reef benthos relative to a 10-meter water column. Mm-hmm. So at 10 meters depth, the water column microbes, it's about as many floating around as just on that one-dimensional surface in a square meter.
Thanks.
The number I always remember that I tell my swimmer friends is when the ocean is really clear, when you can see the bottom, it's still 10 to the 6 microbes per ml.
I also have a question. When you've got global warming and all the melt from the glaciers, about how long is it going to take for the meltwater to get a supply of microbes in that, since the freshwater ones seem to be slower growing?
So Ellen, your question is about the meltwater from glaciers and sea ice,
yeah.
coming into the ocean. The microbes that are being introduced, is that it? From
that and those who will then somehow move to take over that space.
Yes, so when one looks at microbes growing in ice, it's in pockets where there's water, and it tends to be the briny pockets. And those numbers can be quite high. The microbes that people see in those environments, like in the Arctic, multi-year ice, are very different from the populations in the seawater surrounding the ice. So they're distinct populations of microbes with their own unique adaptations. And so I wouldn't imagine that they would fare particularly well in seawater because they are adapted to a different ice-enclosed environment.
I'd like to ask Jim a question, and that is to fill us in on the state of the International Whaling Commission, because what I have read is that it's politically weaker than it was a couple of years ago. And could you tell us something about the status now of the International Whaling Commission?
The International Whaling Commission was founded by whaling nations, and right now, the members of the International Whaling Commission, majority of nations say we're not going to whale again. So it is quite serves quite a different purpose today, and much to the dismay of the few nations that one in particular, Japan, that has continued whaling under the guise of scientific research, and two other nations that have resumed whaling in the last handful of years, Iceland and Norway. So the commission continues to meet, continues to debate these issues, but the whole dynamic is very different today. Some American citizens, some U.S. citizens are unaware that U.S. citizens kill whales every year, that there is a subsistence harvest, which is approved by the International Whaling Commission for many nations, including the United States. So there are Americans living on the coast of Alaska who every year have a quota for whales. The Japanese have recently challenged that, saying that we're hypocritical if we're allowing subsistence harvest in the U.S. and opposing the Japanese sort of research harvest. But we know, of course, that the Japanese have been rather cavalier about their research harvest, and that there's not a body of published literature that shows what they've learned from this. And we know that most of that harvest ends up in the market.
Opinion of the fishing policies that now have been adopted in New England? You know, there are displaced fishermen. I'm sure you know about that.
Fishery policies in New England? Well, Stuart showed us what's happened to fish stocks, and this, if I were to talk about realizations and going, I think Lisa described it well, humans as a keystone species. Here's another example where the science has been clear for a long time. And because of political meddling and interference, we've failed to make use of that information. As we've seen the projections of fisheries biologists showing that if we continue to harvest at current levels, the stocks will fall into further decline. And as we saw just in the last couple of years, the cod stock,
yes.
This is the first year that, I think perhaps the first year ever, that the shrimp harvest in the Gulf of Maine has been restricted, no harvest this year. We're seeing the cod populations dwindle, not only in terms of abundance, and but of course the large cod. This is something that Jeremy Jackson loves to talk about. When you take the large fish out, you dramatically affect the reproductive capacity of that stock. So. You only have to sort of read the Boston Globe or the New York Times to realize that this is a failure of the policy process. And I could just say, personally, in Massachusetts, it certainly has not had a partisan party character to it. Republicans and Democrats have both shamelessly pandered to the fishermen, saying we have to protect their livelihoods, and have beat up on the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA as being too stringent, and they're wrong.
Charlie?
Yeah, I could comment a little bit on that. About 10 years ago, I served on something called the Pew Oceans Commission, and there we examined the behavior of the 17 NOAA Fisheries Management Council. They're distributed around the country, and the management councils have a decision recommendation process that goes to NOAA to set next year's catch based on the best available science. And usually they go to the default condition, which was last year's catch, which was the last thing that they could agree upon, or maybe 10 years ago, and in complete disregard of the scientific assessment. And what we found was the psychological dynamics was the NOAA manager of the council had to arrive at a consensus recommendation. And the recommendations that would come forward from the science would always displease one half of the industry side of the council. Somebody would be disappointed. And at that point, all they needed to say was, do you have the best available science? And every scientist would say, no, we'd like more. And so at that point, then having to reach an agreement this year on its schedule, bureaucratic schedule, they would go to the last thing they agreed on. And the other remark that's worth saying is that we found that because of the fisheries in New England are the most deeply implanted culturally, having been started actually prior to the settlement of New England, those councils, the New England Council was the most intransigent.
So one thing we have talked just a little about, Charlie's example right now, is public policy. So how can we get public policy involved in protecting the ocean and good ocean stewardship? And one of the things, I mean, Lisa is an expert on the continental shelf, and they're setting up to start mining it. So Lisa, can you say something about that? And is public policy at all involved? Is the UN or someone involved in protecting the continental margins?
Well, can I talk about the whole ocean there?
Yeah, talk about the whole ocean.
The margins are, complicated. We have 200-mile exclusive economic zones, which with 150 or 180 countries, each with their own set of rules about how to manage those. Then we have international waters, and for the seafloor, the minerals are under the jurisdiction of the International Seabed Authority. And any nation that has signed and ratified the law of the sea, the UN law of the sea, is eligible to make a claim for those international minerals. And that's starting to happen right now at a rapid rate. So that for manganese nodules, for massive sulfides, for cobalt crusts, they're all starting to lease seamounts in mid-ocean ridge areas and abyssal seafloor. And there are, I think, forget the number of countries, 15 countries alone have massive claims the size of basically whole countries in the Clarion-Clipperton fracture zone where off Mexico, where there are manganese nodules that extend for thousands of kilometers. So what's problematic is that there is an agency that's in charge of setting the environmental regulations, but the governance of the UN Law of the Sea really only manages the minerals and not the life forms on the seafloor. So that agency is supposed to protect the environment at the same time that they promote mining. And the regulations, the environmental regulations aren't in place. It's one of the reasons the Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative was formed, to help provide guidance on holistic environmental management of the deep sea floor. The other thing people might not realize is that any country that makes an international claim has to enact laws in it, for mining within their EEZs that are at least as stringent as the international laws. And the big problem right now is those international laws don't exist, or regulations don't exist. So it's going to be very, very important that the ISA create a set of regulations that ultimately will protect all of the ocean, including the continental margins.
So would anyone in the audience like to add anything about public policy? Yes?
Well, I work in public policy.
Wait for that.
I think what's important for the scientific community to learn is that you have to work in collaboration with public policy experts. And so I'm not aware of any journal that is particularly focused on the public policy of the oceans or the environment. I don't know if there's
a journal called Marine Policy.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, I'm not aware of it, but I mean, I think there needs to be more collaboration in between the scientists and those communicating to public policy and to the policymakers and to the public to make them more aware of these issues.
Here, here. This is one of the goals of CNBC, is to translate science to policy and work with the people who do it and to train students who are able to make that leap.
Great.
So we're out of time now. So I'd like to thank all the speakers and the audience.